Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 1st of February 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. And we're delighted to be joined by David Scott, reporting from north of the border with northern exposure. And I believe there are a few snowflakes coming down in Perth. Not here, though, Mike.
No. There was a bit last night, quite a bit last night, but okay, today it's all gone.
So the disaster, of course, many people suffering in the snow, but down here in Plymouth, not a lot.
No. Well, let's move across to Europe. And we're going to begin with Federica Mogherini. Here she is. This is the informal defence and foreign affairs meeting of the European Council, which is taking place in Bucharest yesterday and the day before. And so with defence ministers, she was talking about, in fact, talking with NATO and the United Nations about EU defence unification. They were discussing their common work, in particular peace and security, but defence was the main thing, as I say. Our partnership with NATO is key, said Federica the previous night. I'm going to show a little bit of what she said at the end of this meeting in a moment. But she said the partnership with NATO is key. It's been strengthened over these last years. And the fact that we've managed to strengthen European defence at the same time strengthen EU-NATO cooperation is really something that makes me proud. And I want to thank Jens Stoltenberg for his personal contribution to this work. Now, of course, Jens Stoltenberg was at the meeting, so it wasn't just an EU defence meeting, because NATO was represented. But let's just listen to what Federica had to say at the close of the meeting yesterday.
This morning, ministers discussed the way forward on the European defence. You know that in a few years we have established a completely new pattern of cooperation on European defence. It is particularly a reason of pride for me because this is a field where European cooperation has been stalling or postponed for decades. And a couple of years ago, we managed to advance on this historic issue. And ministers assessed today that the level of implementation of all the different decisions we have taken on European defence are progressing well. We have decided to consolidate the existing EU defence initiatives, starting from the Permanent Structured Cooperation. We have now more than 30 projects ongoing. And others, like, for instance, the European Defence Fund, in a coordinated manner and with a lot of energy and focus on consolidating them and delivering results. I will present a report to the Council on this by the summer. The ministers also the need to integrate the new European Union tools on defence into the national defence planning systems. This is extremely important to make full use of all the potential of these instruments.
So we need to make a couple of things clear here, Brian, just before you comment. First thing is, when we speak to politicians in the UK about this issue, they keep saying that the core focus is NATO and EU defence can't do anything which would possibly duplicate or undermine NATO. She made it clear in her opening remarks or in the dinner speech that she gave the night before, she made that statement that the partnership with NATO is key. So she is absolutely 100% on board with that idea. But what we see here, Brian, is that up to now we have had this process of acronyms, various acronyms coming out of the EU with regards to defence, PESCO being one, CARD being another. And what she's just said is that it's now time to bring all these things together. So they're talking about moving the agenda forward much more quickly to bring all the various sections of defence union that they've already created together to form the real defence union. That is clearly where they're going at this point.
Clearly where they're going. We've got another section on this later in the news today. But the thing I pick up on, Mike, is it's words. She's just producing words and a spiel, a lot of new speak in there. We've reported in the last few days that Germany's military forces are in an appalling state. So the Navy is barely operational, new frigates not accepted, submarine fleet non-operational, German army unable to muster three divisions, and yet it's supposed to be the backbone of armed forces. Germany is making a decision about replacement fighter aircraft. So if you look at the reality of it at the moment, the whole of the EU military system is a disaster area. But she stands up and says, well, we've been talking about it and the whole thing's moving forward. They want to create the unified structure, but it's words and rhetoric. They are really living in their own reality at the moment.
But they have to create the problem, which is going to drive the public support for this.
Yes, and that's why the money's being put in the pot. So when the Treasury, the EU Treasury comes, of course, that will be complete.
David, let me welcome you to the programme and just say, what are your thoughts on this?
I thought that was a fascinating little talk there. I completely agree with you that the key word there is consolidate. We're taking all of these elements which we had identified as being a prototype for the EU military union. They're being consolidated, so that's the full beast being revealed. The NATO issue is clearly a non-issue. This is the one that in the UK is used to put everyone to sleep. It's okay, NATO. NATO will safeguard us. But remember what Trump said ever since the wall came down in Berlin, NATO's obsolete. It is. It's becoming something else. NATO's the handmaiden or the Trojan horse to bring EU military union in. It's not a safeguard against it. It's actually enabling technology.
Absolutely. Now, just to remind everybody, we were running a poll in the past week on what people thought about this issue of Britain's involvement in EU Defence Union, and there are the results. So 6% said yes, 4% said not fully, and 90% said not at all. So that is a pretty clear result, Brian.
It's a clear result, and it is a poll, and there's a very clear result on that, which is not surprising when people have the information as to what's actually going on. The big problem, of course, is we still have the general public at large not understanding what's being done behind closed doors.
Well, you were talking about the German military a minute ago. Well, the news has broken in a number of sources now that Germany has decided not to go ahead purchasing the F-35. So this is really unfortunate for Lockheed Martin, of course. $3.4 billion of orders was expected to come from Germany. And Germany wants to replace their aging Tornadoes and Eurofighters. And so they think that the Eurofighter is probably, if it's refitted, is probably going to be able to manage to continue until 2035, I think, on the basis that, with the payloads that it currently has to carry. But it seems that the main driver for this decision actually isn't whether they're going to buy from Lockheed or from Airbus or Boeing, as some people are suggesting, but actually the fact that they are working on a fifth generation fighter of their own with the French. In fact, it's a French initiative which Germany's getting involved in, and so it seems that is the main driver for this decision, Brian.
Yeah, it's quite an amazing situation, Mike. And then we've already reported on the fact that Germany's run into trouble with its maritime patrol aircraft. It's expecting another joint deal with the French in order to do that. So if we just talk levels of competence, which is a word that the EU likes to misuse, but we'll talk about competence. We've got two of the key leading countries, France and Germany. They can't even work together within the environment of the EU in order to build new military equipment. Mm. But as we've said, the Chinese and the Russians, by building in-house, are producing excellent equipment. Mm. So something deeply flawed with the EU. But more problems here in UK with the announcement that we're about to head into a 7 billion equipment black hole for the military. And now the UK defence budget at the moment is about 36.5 billion. We're talking about a 7 billion black hole, and that could be up to somewhere, I think, about 12 billion by 2030. So major problems in UK. We're going to say the same thing. This is not a strange occurrence of incompetence in UK. This is engineered in order to help unite us within that EU defence system. Of course, Brexit's thrown a bit of a spanner in the works with that. But we've never seen Britain's military forces in such a perilous position. And this cannot simply be incompetence. Well, what's come on the back of it? We're coming back into our subject to the Constitution. And thank you very much to the viewer who sent us this one this morning. This is the Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Committee, which is launching in March a new inquiry examining the constitutional underpinning for decisions to use military force. Encourage people to go onto the government website, have a look at the detail. I can just call up on screen part of it, which is what they've actually called for in submissions. We'll do this very quickly. To what extent is the deployment military force a necessary responsibility and function of government? What are the conventions governing the deployment of military force? How has the use of the royal prerogative to authorise military force changed over time? Is the royal prerogative still the appropriate mechanism for deploying military force? Since 2003, how has the involvement of Parliament in authorising the use of military force affected the conventions governing its deployment? What role, if any, should Parliament have in the authorisation of military force? How should this role be assured? What can the UK learn from international comparators? Now, of course, the subtlety here is that the government can authorise that military force, but not Parliament, hence the questions. But what's really going on here is this is an attack on sovereignty. This is not simply to do with defence. This is sovereignty and it's the Constitution, but it's being drifted in. Luckily, we have people in the wings who are certainly wising up to what's happening. This is a letter that was sent through to us. It's been sent to Nick Gibb MP, and I'll read this one very quickly. Dear Mr. Gibb, I'm at a loss to see how the Attorney General can compose legal advice which concludes that a political settlement may be made which is not necessarily compliant, if at all, with the rule of our law and the limitations of the Crown. His advice to the Prime Minister is that the government must make a political settlement and implies that it may well not be in accordance with our law. Surely this cannot be, as to set aside the limitations of the Crown which require that sovereignty be upheld. Reign long is to be in contempt of statute. The Crown may not be placed in breach of its oaths? Please would you kindly ask the Attorney General to confirm that Her Majesty must fulfil the obligations of her oath, which make it the entrenched duty of the Crown to maintain to the best of the Crown's powers our sovereignty in accordance with the connected enactments securing the rights and liberties of the people. It goes on to say, or to ask, by what authority may the government undertake any action which might continue the existing breaches of sovereignty or act in contrary manner to the limitations of the Crown? And finally, the question is that the requirement of allegiance and duty to obey the law of all those in governance demands the recovery of sovereignty as their immediate, bounden and imperative duty. So somebody's picking up on the facts that the government, even through the relationship with the EU and what is being talked about in Brexit, but we're now seeing it with the military, the Constitution is being attacked and the sovereignty of the nation. But this particular individual is clearly on the button and asking the right questions. Let's just remind ourselves that it was Nick Clegg back in 2010 that was working for massive constitutional change. Certainly there was no real mandate for him to do this. And the question we're going to ask is, in 2019, are we now seeing treason by pretense? And this is from Sir William Blackstone's analysis that the third species of treason is essentially if there is an attempt to undermine the king, to undermine sovereignty, using pretense to reform religion or the laws or to remove evil counsellors or other grievances, whether real or pretended. Now, that is a fundamental document at law and a key sentence. We're asking the question, have we now got treason by pretense underway? And a few days ago, we reminded people that we now had the situation where the Queen had attended Parliament without her crown, but instead a rather Euro blue starred hat. And UKIP in the last few days has written a letter to the Queen talking about sovereignty and constitution. Finally, UKIP is using the term treason. So serious things are afoot. And of course, much of this is being done under the general turmoil of Brexit.
Well, let's move straight on to Iran. A joint statement has been issued today by the foreign ministers of France, Germany and the United Kingdom. So they say that France, Germany and the United Kingdom, in accordance with their resolute commitment and continued efforts to preserve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action endorsed by the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231, announced the creation of INTEX SAS. This is the Instrument for Supporting Trade Exchanges, a special purpose vehicle aimed at facilitating legitimate trade between European economic operators and Iran. So this is in order to get round American sanctions. They're saying that INTEX will support legitimate European trade with Iran, focusing initially on the sectors most essential to the Iranian population, such as pharmaceutical, medical devices and agri-food goods. INTEX aims in the long term to be open to economic operators from third countries who wish to trade with Iran and the E3, which is Britain, France and Germany. And to continue to explore how to achieve this objective. So, David, before I make any more comment on this, it's interesting that France, Germany, and Britain are attempting to sort of get around the dollar problem in this way.
Yes, the dollar problem. How many times are we going to use that phrase in 2019, I wonder? And it's not just France and Germany that are moves afoot. In Russia and in China and in other places to form alternatives to the Bretton Woods system or what's left of it, and alternatives to the dollar. And this is all part of the drawback in American power, the reduction in American soft power that not even Trump will stop, and the change to a multipolar world that we're seeing.
So let me ask you this question. Are you aware of the E3?
No, that's a new phrase on me. I've never heard the E3 before. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Well, it is interesting, David, because I just want to draw people's attention to two things here. The first one, of course, is the Franco-German summit, which has just taken place in Aachen, where they signed their new treaty, their Franco-German treaty. And remember, this includes defence, but it also includes many other areas of policy. And almost exactly a year previously, of course, we had the Franco-British summit in Sandhurst in January 2018, and there were a whole range of treaties came out of it. There was a treaty came out of that covering a whole range of policy areas, including defence. And in fact, I would argue, David, I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but I would argue that the breadth and depth of the Sandhurst treaties are at least as important as far as international relations go as the Aachen treaty. And so what we seem to have through these two bilateral treaties, and you know, correct me if you think I'm wrong, is that we have created the E3 here. This is the first foreign policy statement that I've seen coming out under this sort of guise. But it looks like that's what we've built with these two treaties.
A very interesting observation. It does look that way. And I wonder if we're told everything about these treaties. The previous Aachen agreement at the end of the First World War had secret clauses that were not revealed to the people. I wonder if the current ones have parts of them which are not considered to be capable of being explained to the likes of you and me.
Good question. More work required, I think, on that. Now, let's head over to France, and this is Le Monde, and their headline is basically, well, the article is talking about the use of plastic bullets, of baton rounds in France for the yellow vests, demonstrations. They're saying the future of the plastic bullet launchers was being discussed, or at least brought in a case, on Wednesday before the State Council. This is the highest French administrative court, and it's been asked to look at the question of whether the police should be allowed to use these so-called weapons. They're being described as being intermediate strength. There's a decision to be expected this morning at some point. And we hadn't heard what the result of that was before we came on air. But this was being considered extremely urgent. And they were highlighting the risks of physical injury and showing, as part of the submissions, the injuries that people had sustained, particularly to head injuries. So they were listing 159 injuries to the head. And they were saying that, you know, basically this weapon is not made for policing. Now, here's the key figure. 9,228 of these flashball rubber bullets have been used in the 2 months of the protests so far. And bearing in mind that these are only weekend protests. So, you know, that's quite a staggering number. And just to put that in perspective, from 1973 until 2005, there were 125,000 batten rounds used in Northern Ireland. Now, that was supposed to be some kind of low intensity war conflict zone. So there were regular riots and so on. And so 125,000 used in 32 years. And so at the rate that France is going at the moment, they'll have gone through 125,000 in just over 2 years. So, you know, it is slightly ironic here, by the way, that in 1982, the European Parliament was calling for the banning of these because of the death of a boy in Northern Ireland. Here we have France using them with impunity.
Well, you don't want a consistent line. It's whatever suits the political elite at the time, and they're worried. Macron's worried.
Absolutely. David, briefly.
Yes, I can remember that report in 1982. I remember how much that was in the British press and how much the media was concentrating on the death of that boy. And it does rather contrast with the silence over the harm being caused to the protesters in France.
Absolutely. Now, David, what's going on in Scotland with respect to the common law court? Now, you've mentioned this a couple of times in recent weeks because a couple of the organisers have been appearing in court, in Sheriff's Court, that is. So just bring us up to date with this.
Yes, so the common law court, a case was brought before the common law court concerning some of the decisions made by the standard courts in Scotland, which resulted in a child being seized by the state. And the jury that was assembled found against some individuals, including sheriffs, and their conduct in this matter. Now, when this case was coming forward, documentation was sent to the sheriffs, alerting them to the case, giving them an opportunity to resolve matters, giving them an opportunity to attend and present a defence. This documentation has been interpreted by the justice system in Scotland as threatening, as a breach of the peace, as causing fear and alarm. So it's rather ironic that the Scottish Courts and Tribunal Service are currently arguing that receiving documentation alerting you to a court case is actually a breach of the peace. But that's what's happening. So that case is ongoing. So this next slide is just to remind people when the case is next being heard. As John Smith and Robert Sproul are two defendants that are separate but kind of conjoined by the state. And the next hearing is at Paisley Sheriff Court on the 5th of February. Now, this relates to whether or not the people have a right to form courts, and what authority and from whence the authority of the current courts derives. If it's not from the people, what's it from? And we're not really very sure what the answer is. Now, one of the things the common law court has done is it started a campaign where people were taking selfies with a sign saying, "I am the common law court." Now, there are going to be hundreds of these. So if people want to support the common law court and show that it's everybody, and that it's in the internet, it's in the ether, and it's people joining together to seek justice, then that's a good way of showing your support. And they've also put forward a declaration, and they've had 100 people sign this declaration, this is available on their website. One paragraph couple of paragraphs here maybe worth quickly reading out. It says, we the people have inherent birthrights established by our creator, which protect us from harm, loss and injury from others. For many years now, men and women have been subjected to criminal and fraudulent behaviour by the state's actions, which have been imposed upon us against our will by both criminal coercion and legal deception. Fear and fiction have thus combined to bind us into slavery. The state has committed attacks, injustices, killings, robberies, theft, unlawful imprisonment and countless other enormous outrages against the people, sparing no one on account of age, sex or position. To this robbery, slaughter and plunder, they give the lying name of government. They have stripped us of our ancient freedoms and call it progress. So that gives you an idea of the sort of tone there. And these are people standing up and saying, yes, we oppose what's being done to us. But they're looking to do it in a lawful way. They're looking to do it in a way which stands upon the law. These are very difficult areas, but this is something we're all going to have to look at, because as the state becomes more and more aggressive, as our rights are more and more trampled, there comes the question, what does a lawful man or woman do?
Good question. Okay, well, look, let's move on from that. Just a brief reminder that if you like what UK Column is doing, please consider supporting us. You can do that by joining the UK Column community. Go to ukcolumn.org/community if you'd like to do that. Your assistance would be much appreciated. And a reminder that AV9.1 DVD set is now available through the UK Column website if you want to get a copy of those discs. Fantastic presentations from Brian, from Alex Thompson, Patrick Henningsen, Dr. Graham Downing and Ian R. Crane. Okay, what's next?
This is an advert for a meeting about the dangers of 5G, which is going to be in Buckfast, Lee, Devon on February the 22nd, 7:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. And that's £5 on the door, some £3 concessions. But of course, many people now warning of the dangers of 5G. And this will be a very informative talk about those problems.
Okay, now, organ donations, and the organ donation deemed consent bill is proceeding through Parliament. It's since it's gone through its committee stages into the House of Lords for a line by line scrutiny of the contents. So this was originally, it's a private member's bill. It was tabled by the Labour MP Geoffrey Robinson, and it passed through the various procedures to actually get on the list of private members' bills that would progress. Obviously, at the moment, with organ donations in England, because Scotland and Wales have and Northern Ireland, this falls under devolution, so they have their own arrangements, which perhaps David can comment on in a second. But in England, at least, this is still an opt-in system, so you've got to actually volunteer to be considered for to have your organs removed at the point of your death for transplant and so on. And this comes under the Human Tissue Act 2004. And then in October 2017, if you remember, Theresa May said that the government was going to introduce an opt-out consent system. So in other words, consent would be presumed. This is the legislation which is going to enable that if it manages to go through. So it's being done as a private member's bill, as I say, and normally these would not progress, but because this one actually has the support of government, it is progressing. So David, in Scotland at the moment, this is a separate thing. You already have presumed consent, is that correct?
No, it's coming forward. It's still an opt-in system as far as I'm aware, but it's a similar situation that they're going to change that to an opt-out. But that's not yet gone through Parliament.
Okay. Well, look, we just want to remind everybody that if you want to sort of get a balanced view of the issues surrounding this, have a look on the UK Column website for the article No Time to Die by Dr. Mike Williams. And really he's questioning whether this presumption of consent is a wise thing to do. People can make up their own minds. And really he's questioning the issue of, you know, at what point are organs removed, because of course organs have to be removed while they're still extremely fresh if they're going to go into somebody else. And he's highlighting this quote here from this is from a nurses forum. where they were talking about the issue of anaesthesia given to people that are supposedly dead and having organs removed. And so just to quote this, it says, yes, the role of the anaesthesia provider in organ donation is to keep the patient alive and keep the organs healthy. Typically, the only anaesthetic medication given to a patient is muscle relaxant to make it easier to make an abdominal incision and to harvest the organs. And so it goes on. And then the response to that, that was the response to a question that was being asked. So, you know, the point here is you're not given an anaesthetic. The drugs that are given are to maintain the body and also a paralyzing drug called a non-depolarizing blocking agent. So this paralyzes you while the organs are removed and there's no anaesthetic. And the point of the article is just really to say that a lot of this information is not given to the public. So if there's still time to contact your MP if you feel that this is an important issue. You know, there's a lot of support for this notion of presumed consent, but I think it's uninformed support because people aren't getting the full picture.
It's amazing. Anything to do with death, the state seems to progress with great enthusiasm and gusto. I've read over the last couple of days that somewhere, I think it must be America, but they're now looking at abortion of babies up until the time of birth. So what is actually going on? We seem to have a government and a system which is obsessed basically with death and not looking after people who are in this world. David, is it just me or is there something very dark on its way?
Oh, dark it is, and a death cult it is. Also, always watch out for words which you know the meaning of and you hold as important. Is it suddenly paired with other words? Presumed consent doesn't mean what consent means, because consent only means express, voluntary, individual, informed consent. It's like social justice, which means group justice, which means achieving identical outcomes using personal injustice. Often it reverses the meaning.
Yes. Okay, David, let's head over for some Scottish news. And this is Maggie Mellon. And she's asking, or she's saying, to get justice in Scotland, you must be rich or popular.
Yes, this is, I think, an extremely important article. This is in the Scottish Review. And she's looking at a case where children have been seized by the state and parents have been blamed. And then all rules have been waived by the state. All safeguards, all protections have been ignored. The basic ethos, the basic reasoning that the state gave for making this action in the first place was proved to be wrong, but the children were not returned. The accusations against the parents are essentially accusations you could make against any sets of parents anywhere in the country, because what's happening is the state will gather information about the normal family life, and they will paint that as a criminal, in a criminal or welfare deficient manner, and they will interpret it thus and take action accordingly. And there is no justice unless you're very, very rich or have access to almost unlimited public support in the way that Alex Salmond had. Then you are lost in the Scottish system. There's no justice.
Well, I don't think that applies just to the Scottish system, does it? Because, you know, any court system in the UK wide actually, of course, is held in secret with respect to the family courts. You can't. There's no press coverage. There's no juries involved. So, you know, we have covered many, many cases over the years where there has been nothing but injustice through the family courts, and Linda Lewis being the first.
Yeah, and of course, for people to understand this, you've got to be able to go into those family courts, which is why in the early days we made an effort to get into the courts alongside families, principally as a Mackenzie friend, so that you could see, witness, hear the procedure being carried out. And what clearly was happening was nothing to do with justice. Mm. But of course, the jury is denied because that supposedly would be against the rights of the child to have other people hearing the case. So we've got justice in secret south of the border. And we'll also say, of course, that Melanie Shaw, we're now fairly certain, has been moved to Rampton Hospital. But we have no idea if there was another court hearing where that took place. So if we use Melanie Shaw as one example, somebody that tried to speak out, whistleblow on child abuse, the state has silenced by putting through what has been a largely secretive court process.
In the meantime, David, in Scotland, more justice here, because the headline from STV here is "Mum's anger as court explains why child abuser walked free."
Yes, this was a young man who assaulted a six-year-old girl. He would be 16, 17 at the time. I think he was 15 when the abuse started. And the sheriff considered the offence to be the result of an entirely inappropriate curiosity of an emotionally naive teenager rather than for the purpose of sexual gratification. So the sheriff knew that somehow. The girl's mum said, "I am absolutely gobsmacked by this. How can he possibly know this? It also seems to be at odds with the charge, which was sexual assault." He also says, "My daughter appears not to have suffered any long-lasting effects. Again, how can he possibly know this? No one has asked me at any point how my daughter is." So here you see, again, very strange and random justice.
Well, it's a bit more than strange and random justice, isn't it? Because I have a real problem with this statement here. He also says that my daughter appears not to have suffered any long-lasting effects, because, of course, this was the argument put forward by the Paedophile Information Exchange and the National Council on Civil Liberties, now Liberty, when Harriet Harman and Patricia Hewitt were involved in the campaign to normalise paedophilia in the UK. It was the same type of language. So if a judge is arguing that it's okay because a daughter appears not to have suffered long-lasting effects, is he of the same mind then as the people that were campaigning for the normalisation of paedophilia in the UK? That's the first question that comes to my mind.
That's an excellent question, because it does seem to be that's what he's saying. And I would point out that this young man is not on the sex offenders register. He's served, although he's been found guilty, he's had no action taken by the state against him at all, no community service, no nothing. The Scottish Government tweeted out today, "We are dedicated to making Scotland an inclusive country where everyone, no matter their sexual orientation or identity, feels safe to be themselves. Together we can make a Scotland we can all be proud of." Now, this is obviously badged as an LGBT initiative, but of course, that if you just look at those words, everyone, no matter what their sexual orientation, we wonder where that will stop.
Well, indeed. And now we're running out of time. So just very briefly, David, if you could, Scottish education. We're going to remove music tuition from students in Scotland.
Yeah, Midlothian is cancelling all music tuition unless you're already involved in music exams. And this shows that as we're taxed more and more, we're getting less and less. This is a recurring theme. And we also see there that we are finding a 9% pay rise for teachers who are threatening to strike. So that's been politically led. So if you have political power, you'll do better. And the EIS, Educational Institute of Scotland, Teachers Union, certainly does have political power. So that's the lesson, I suppose.
But in the meantime, you're getting new taxes. And, you know, I wouldn't be voting for independence at this point, because it's pretty clear that if the SNP was to end up with an independent Scotland, that you guys would be taxed to oblivion.
Yes, I think that's a fair comment. And they're being backed up by the Green Party, which is the SNP's kind of guerrilla gardening wing, who always back them up. And they're exploiting the PR system to get a small number of votes, and gives them the sort of swing numbers, the balance of power in Parliament. So they are having huge effects despite not having much support amongst the people. And they are basically even more authoritarian and extreme left wing and for the big state than are the SNP. Mm.
We've covered the constitution. We will end on something around Brexit without the exit. So let's have a look at something that the European Union is up to. Now, UK column, Mike, you in particular have talked about disinformation, but this is fascinating. And thank you, the person who alerted us to it. It's Foreign Affairs Council, 21st of January, written statement. Sir Alan Duncan, Minister of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs. My right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs, attended the Foreign Affairs Council on the 21st January. It was chaired by the High Representative and Vice President of the European Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy. That's Federica Mogherini. The meeting was held in Brussels. So let's just remind ourselves. Here's Alan Duncan. And he's been in a bit of a sticky position over whether Brexit is good or not. We'll see a bit more of that in a minute. But this is one of his statements. The wish to restore the power to govern ourselves is a perfectly respectable argument. And the rise of UKIP and the undimmable forces within the Conservative Party who want to leave the EU are testament to the enduring irritation many feel. So you might feel that this man has at least got some thoughts for people who want to get out of the EU. Well, has he? But what was he doing? Well, as the government's talking Brexit, he was getting involved with this. Disinformation. The council discussed the action plan against disinformation that was presented by the High Representative and European Commission on the 5th of December. Ministers expressed strong support for the plan and exchanged views on implementation. It goes on to say the Council highlighted the creation of an EU rapid alert system to share expertise and best practice to promote coordinated action, notably through awareness raising campaigns. Ministers stressed the need to engage with civil society, business and academia to tackle disinformation as well as to work with international partners such as NATO and the G7 on this issue. The Council agreed that the EU's operational capacity should be strengthened, including by reinforcing the three European External Action Service strategic communication task forces. It's like reading something out of Cold War Soviet literature here. But this led to a very interesting little diagram, because this is this three task force organisation. Let me just call it up on the other screen. So we've got the European External Action Service here. And if we highlight a few things, we've got the Deputy Secretary General for Economic and Global Issues. We've got this one, which is Deputy Secretary General for Political Affairs and the Political Director. It's straight out of the Soviet, yeah. Except this is the EU. But it's this little box here which caught my eye. So let's bring that on screen. What have we actually got? Well, here we're into a real focus principally on the Eastern Front. The European calls it the Eastern Border. But we've got a gentleman looking after security. Sorry, the header is security. Sorry, Deputy Secretary General for CSDP and Crisis Response. We've got a security policy head. We've got intelligence situation, crisis management, civilian planning and conduct. But over on the right hand side, it's amazing to see that we've actually got a full declaration of European Union military staff. And that includes military planning and conduct, includes concepts and capabilities, intelligence, operations, logistics, communication and information systems. So there is absolutely no doubt that the EU has already installed its military. Of course, Mogherini is the head of this system at the moment. So utter lies that we're simply talking about a European army in the future. The system's already here. Bring ourselves back to Alan Duncan. And of course, this was reported in the Telegraph a little while ago that he was for staying in the European Union, but he was for joining the Leave organisation. Nobody was too sure where he was coming from. But at the moment, while the government's talking Brexit, he's been overseas to work alongside the EU as they install what must be the biggest propaganda and civilian control organisation Europe has ever seen, or at least since the Nazis were in power. David, the style of this European documentation, the way it's set up, it is a Soviet.
Yes, and is it just me, or can I just visualise that somewhere down the bottom of that organisation chart, there's going to be added on the chief of the defence staff, and then the head of the, or below him, the head of the Royal Navy, the Army, and the Air Force, that that our Her Majesty's Armed Forces are going to be subservient to everything we just saw there.
Indeed. Now, we're on the stops for time, but I'll just call these up on screen so that people can freeze the screen. This is a leaflet, the action plan against disinformation. So you can read on one page what the EU has really got planned, and they're going to control everything from the web to the press and media and what's happening amongst social networking and communities. On the right is the document itself, the joint communication to the European Parliament, the European Council, the Council, the European Economic and Social Committee, and the Committee of the Regions Action Plan Against Disinformation. This is the sort of thing they're talking about. And here is why I'm focusing on the new European Eastern Front, because they're talking about the importance of the Eastern and Southern neighbourhood and in the Western Balkans. And they're absolutely going for the Russians in this text. And they go on to talk about an independent media is essential for the functioning of a democratic society. But they then describe how they are going to be in their monitoring and indeed controlling the media. So I encourage people to go and look at this document. This is the conclusion, that disinformation is a major challenge for the European Union and its value and freedoms. I know it's very difficult to get hold of. Strong commitment and swift action is going to be necessary. And they're particularly worried about the up and coming European Union elections. But if you read this text, you can see that they're going to take control of everything possible to control what people read and what information circulates on the internet. And we'll leave you with the image of Merkel, because, of course, she is one of the leading drivers of this what do we describe it as? Evil empire, I think, is the best I can get to.
Well, I mean, in fairness, they're a lot being a lot more transparent about it than the British Foreign Office is. So, you know, Andy Price is very much involved in what the EU is doing with the Eastern Partnership, but we can't find anything out about what he's doing. We're not allowed to know. But they're publishing organigrams and details of what they're doing. So maybe they're just smug about it. I don't know.
That's true. Perhaps we could ask for some help from our viewers and listeners. If you research this material, you see what we're looking at, what we're reading, then send it to your MP and question them on what's happening. Send it to Full Fact, and of course, send it to mainstream journalists to challenge the reporting. That's it for today. David, thank you very much for joining us. We will be back at the same time on Monday. And a big thank you to all of the people who've been supporting us with donations or joining with memberships. Thank you. Bye-bye.